All the Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome again to All the Rage. And, God, I have no idea what this is going to sound like on the other end, because we are guerrilla recording right now. We are in a corridor in a nondescript building in Fleet Street. We're right next to the elevator, and there is a lot of noise, but we'll do what we can. The Curse of Fleet Street, the last interview I did round here was an audio nightmare as well, but that's another story. I am once again doing an interview with someone as part of our series, so please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Alex Green. I'm a singer, writer, entertainer, activist, primarily on the LGBTQ sort of activism front, and I'm quite impressed with this interview space because it's this wonderful, I think, 1920s lift shaft. It's beautiful, very noisy, but yes, beautiful.
A nice open question then, just describe what you do.
Okay, right, I really describe myself as an entertainer, really, and that's kind of my prime job in life, and I think whether I'm on a stage or just walking down the street. So I run something called Loud and Queerly, which is that primarily we work with sort of queer performers, and those are perhaps, we spend a lot of time sort of working with people who perhaps can't even get on their own queer stage, because if you're not a drag queen, you know, you're generally, you're not the first act to be chosen to perform on queer venues. So we work together, put shows together, you know, take that out. I also say, I earn a living from singing in pubs and weddings and whatever, so that's the bread and butter. But the other things I do, which are connected to that, is I do a lot of activism around, I've done a lot of activism over the years around homelessness. I've set up charities and shelters, Fair Share, the Food Project, which you may have heard of. So I set that up, God knows how many decades ago now. But I've worked for Crisis and Shelter. And funnily enough, I mean, it wasn't until, and the thing I'm involved in specifically now, and have been for the last 4 years, and it feels like 100, is fighting to save and reopen a sort of legendary, historic Black Cap in Camden Town. Yeah, it wasn't until I got involved with that I realised that as a, you know, a gay man, I had done all the marches, I'd, you know, picketed, I'd done everything that I, you know, you're supposed to do as a gay man over the last sort of couple of decades or 3 decades. But I realised I hadn't done very much activism around LGBT stuff, and, you know, and I've got this whole toolkit of history of working for charities, doing other activism, a lot, as I say, around sort of social care and homelessness. And it just struck me that I needed to sort of spend more time, certainly the last, I mean, I'm 56, so this will, oh God, I was 52, I suppose, when I started with the CAP. But I just realised, I thought, if I'm going to spend time bringing that activism strand to life, I really should focus on the LGBT world, and that's really what I focused on, and the CAP's been a catalyst for that, and I'm involved in many other things now, including the Loud and Queerly, which sort of came out of that, because obviously the Black CAP, you may not know this, I'm listeners, but the Black CAP, for those who don't know, was there's been a pub on the high street called the Black Cat for about 350 years. The building that's there now was built in around 1850, 1860, beautiful building. And from around the late 50s, it became a home for, a sort of hidden home, if you like, for queer people, gay people who, well, it was still illegal to be homosexual. So you would sort of, like, there were a few of these venues, they're all over big cities, particularly London, but you would sort of sneak into the venue behind the sort of back alley or whatever and go, and there'd be some drag. I mean, it was all under the pretense of having sort of variety and cabaret. And as the sort of decades went into the 60s and the decade that went on, you started to see more drag appearing there. And then the clientele sort of shifted more towards sort of, you know, a gay clientele. But again, it was still illegal, and right up until 1967, when partial legalisation of homosexuality happened, the CAP had already sort of set its cap, if you like, so excuse the pun, at that group. And it became, you know, one of the few pubs, like the Royal Vauxhall Tavern was another, which, you know, adopted and embraced a sort of gay world through the 70s. And it became known as the Palladium of Drag. It was the place that you would go and see. And a lot of, you know, through that period, you'd get people who were... You'd need one for me.
Sorry, coming back to where we left off, because that bit was a bit noisy, so carry on.
There's more. Okay, so where were we? So, yeah, so after sort of the legalisation in 1967, and I said the CAP had been a place that already was a safe space within the, I put inverted commas there, for gay people and the like. But after legalisation, it really became a pub that sort of presented itself as a gay bar, and a gay bar that specifically and significantly pushed. It's quite a large venue, narrow, long, but a very large venue. So it started on a stage, so it always had a sort of variety in the back. But it became the Palladium of drag, and over the 70s, and it hosted people like Danny LaRue and Mr. Shufflewick, who these are legend names. Google them if you don't know them. Who also crossed over people like Hinge and Bracket, who from the vast depths of your mind you might know those. I mean, in the 70s they had their own TV series, but these people all started or did significant work in the CAP during the sort of late 60s and through the 70s.
A mate of mine used to see Danny LaRue a lot when he was younger. It was Golders Green Palladium or somewhere like that. He used to go, and he said he got to meet him once. He was like, and he said, "Oh, I used to see you at the Palladium." He said, "I fucking closed the place, darling."
But he was like, "What is the love about Danny LaRue?" And it's a joke with other drag queens, because I'm not a drag queen, darling. I'm a female impersonator. I'm an actor, which always makes me laugh if you look back on that. But and it's still funny enough, because most people, sometimes you see people like Dave Lynn, who's brilliant. I think you saw him at the Fox Hall when you came to see the show.
Yeah.
Dave Lynn is this wonderful, who actually started his career at the CAP when he was 16, 17, as a drag queen. And now he's still, is like grandmother of the cabaret scene. But he still refers to that Danny LaRue and how, God, he's not drag. And people, half the time I don't think people know what the hell he's talking about, but it's just funny, do you know what I mean? So through the sort of 70s and 80s, it kind of established itself. And what was great about it, I mean, obviously I wasn't there then, but certainly in the 70s, it established itself as a place that provided, obviously not just a safe space for the newly free over 21-year-old homosexuals, of course, or consenting adults. It also became a real fantastic sort of creative venue for performers, and particularly drag, which had a lot of residents then, kind of drag being a kind of political, I think in a small sense, but political, and it was basically playing with gender and stuff, and it's never really been about good drag. Even then, it was not about female impersonation. It's really about switching the genders, and that's always been the case. But and the CAP sort of changed through the time. So I sort of lopped up there. I came to London in about 1983. I had a record deal. I was 18 with my band, and I'd never, frankly, from Leeds. And I kind of obviously knew I was gay. It was the 80s. Everyone was queer. Do you know what I mean? I came down with me blonde, shock of blonde platinum hair and, my band. And,
I remember having hair.
Yeah, exactly, don't we, boy? And coming in, and to be honest, I'd been, Leeds had a sort of gay bar, but at that time it was sort of end of punk, new romantic stuff, so kind of everywhere was slightly edgy, and how you might describe queer as being alternative, as a, rather than to be anything to do with sexuality or gender.
Yeah, it's more, I mean, I've always found that fascinating, it's the kind of thing of how accepted do you want to be? How mainstream do you want to go to the point where it blunts the edges? Because nothing I've ever really liked has survived the mainstream.
The
culture or music or zines or any of the stuff that I'm into has never really done well if it's adopted by everyone. And I don't mean that to be kind of exclusive and snotty, but frankly, there's a reason why this is non-mainstream.
Exactly. And I'm kind of flip. I mean, I really love the sort of, the out there. I've always felt, I've things I like, things I enjoy. But I'm also, I'm absolutely a pop head. I love when I was growing up, I absolutely loved old soul. I grew up in a house full of mum playing Elvis, my sister's playing the Beatles, and my younger sister's playing, not my younger sister, because I'm the youngest, but the younger sister, playing a lot of old soul, Motown and things. And I absolutely adored all of that and grew up with it. But at the same time, you know, when I was, I think I was 14 when punk hit, and it was just, for me, it was like my sister sort of introduced me to Bowie, and she dyed my hair when I was 14, and then suddenly punk hit, and it was like, oh my God. And I have to, you know, I suppose in my heart of hearts, I didn't particularly like, I mean, I loved the energy of punk music, but I was such a, I loved soul, so but then I loved the energy and the danger of it and the difference, and it was just about being, I guess once it hit, and as we all know, punk lasted about a week, really.
Yeah.
And then it flipped into something else.
And a classic example of once everyone knew what it was, so much of its edges were blunted.
Yeah. And once people, once you had fashion spread, get the punk look, you just knew it was over. But I kind of went, I mean, I think from that, it was like a launching pad. Look, knowing I was gay, it kind of gave you that way of presenting yourself that allowed you to, weirdly, allowed you to put off that inevitable having to come out, because gay people have to come out. You know, you have to go that transition. So I think what was great about the early 80s and all of that movement, and we'd had, you know, sort of glam rock and then punk, and then you kind of got this whole new romantic thing, which was just, and I threw myself into that as an early teen, because it was just, you know, and it freaked people out. But it, I think it, weirdly, when I think about it now, I think it gave me and a lot of people that chance to sort of, just to sort of not have to be, come do that journey of coming out, because you know, everyone was out, really, and so it seemed less of a, even though eventually you still have to, because we do as gay people, you don't have to come out as straight people, but there is a journey you have to take if you're not straight.
Yeah, I've had this conversation with a few mates actually.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's, I mean, God, I'm 56 and it's taken me this long to actually go, same with the baldness, do you know what I mean? I'm not, if you feel as though, but it, you know, it took me a long time to get my head, excuse me again, around the whole issue of gayness, even though I was, you know, I never stopped having sex and enjoying it and being out there, but you know, the idea of it and the acceptance of it myself and the liberation to be it, well, we still don't have that, I don't feel I have that now, but I feel quite liberated in the sense that I'll never, if anyone says to me now, and this has happened to me sometimes, you might be surprised, people might have said to me 10 years ago, well, no one would know you again unless you told them, and I might have at that point gone, well, okay, you know, knowing that they're not being rude, they don't realise that that's actually a ridiculously insensitive thing to say, because they're being kind, because they've grown up with this idea that gay is wrong, and therefore it's sort of a protective thing. But actually now, not that anybody does now, I'm going to make sure, but if someone said that to me now, I would call them in, unless they're being offensive, and I would say, really, what the fuck do I need to do to show, you know, like, what am I doing wrong that you might actually think I'm not gay? Because I don't have a, you know, I'm absolutely wonderfully happy with it and want to celebrate it, because if we don't, then actually people are winning, aren't they? You know, it's like,
oh, completely,
you know.
Yeah, but also, I mean, the thing is, I just find it odd that it's that there's any sense as a boringly straight person, is the way I describe myself, very boringly. So, you know, when you're younger, there's this idea that you might somehow be confused for being, I was just like, I couldn't give a fuck. At this age especially, you know, I really, really couldn't, you know, I'm very, very secure.
I find it incredibly, and it's on the same track, it's like, I just, you know, there's so much shit in the world, isn't there?
Yeah.
The idea that you would preoccupy yourself with, you know, hating or being that angry about someone doing something that you don't, particularly when it's not harming anyone, do you know? I mean,
exactly.
It's about love. I mean, you know, if you can't see love when it's right in front of you, then you really can't see love.
Well, you get,
and
this
that's a song title, thank you. I'll sing that later for you.
We get this thing, you know, with like the whole sort of, I don't know what they do. It's like, they're not doing it on your fucking doormat, mate, so what are you worried about?
I mean, this is
fuck all to do with you.
It's a sort of segue, really, back to the cat.
I don't particularly want to watch you grinding away in the wife of an evening, to be quite honest with you.
And also, I always say, you know, sometimes when I'm doing a stand-up show and someone will kind of go, back to the wall, I'm like, really? Why have you drawn yourself attention to your...
John Bouts, John the Rage, on Tracks FM.
Outer space, find another race.
Just quickly, so coming back to something you said, I was really interested, because although I'm technically too young for punk, which, as you rightly pointed out, lasted a week, it's something that is, I was bitten by the punk rock bug in my early 20s, and I've never recovered.
Yeah.
And one of the things it's talked... Oh, boy. One of the things it's talked about...
That's my leg dropping off, so...
It talks about a little bit less is the real alternative scene that it was, which was, it was, there was a lot of female-fronted bands like the Slits and X-Ray Specs,
yeah,
and a lot of these people who are far too forgotten about now, and then Susie came out of that. But also there was a big LGBT scene. I think maybe not so many of the bands, although I think Pete Shelley was a very relevant example. Yeah. And especially in America, because I remember hearing people like Henry Rollins talk about when he played with Black Flag, and he said, look, you know, we didn't play in big venues, we played in clubs. And a lot of time they were, you know, LGBT clubs, and yeah, a few of the audience got there, but we didn't give a fuck, because it goes, when I grew up in Washington, that's, I was surrounded by people like that all the time, they were part of the scene.
Yeah.
And it feels a bit like maybe they've maybe intentionally been written out, or maybe just unintentionally.
I went to see this a brilliant film actually about a year ago, and I forgot what it was called, but it's a queer something, and it was about the kind of queer movement in America through the 70s,
okay,
which was absolutely what you've just described. It was kind of, a lot of people sort of argue that punk came out of that. So it was a lot of, you know, really hardcore bands playing thrash music, what we describe now. But a lot of them were gay, and a lot of them were just outsiders, and
yeah,
you know. And there was a lot of, you know, kind of radical lesbians and feminists and things come out of that scene.
All the way up to the 90s as well.
Yeah, and it's, well, and it's kind of what I find really exciting about now, actually, is, like, through the 70s, I think that gave rise to it. And then through the 80s, you had, I think, a kind of commercialisation of gayness.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that was kind of my era, you know, sort of come out in the 80s. I never really kind of felt, you know, you knew it was kind of, people didn't approve of it, but it was a bit like, well, fuck that, do you know what I mean? Because the 80s allowed you to be, and building on that kind of, I think, queer movement, and then fed into punk.
It was an extreme decade.
It was, and it was...
Which I still don't think we've recovered from in a lot of ways.
Well, I think what happened in the 80s, and being right in the middle of it as a teenager, and then, you know, as a musician and artist and performer, but also as, you know, coming to London, I did allow me that kind of freedom of, even though I kind of, but I never really said I was gay, it was because it was so, you didn't really need to see it in Leeds in the 80s, you know.
Yeah.
And unless you wanted to go down the New Penny, which was the one pub, which I didn't. and I didn't, to be honest, didn't need to, because, you know, we were all in our, you know, punk, new romantic world. But when I moved here, I was just about 18, and it was weird, you know, you come, and the first pub I actually went into was a proper gay pub. I'd been to Heaven, the nightclub, and things like that. Yeah. I was about 18, nearly 19. And went into the Black Cap, and even though it was a grubby, sort of slightly sordid place in many ways, I loved it, because it was just not only, it was just full of a mix of people that we would now describe as like a kind of queer mix, you know, it wasn't just sort of gay men. And a lot of the bars at that time were already very, what we'd call, they're called cloney, you know, leather or mustachio.
Formalised.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so people would have their tribe. So you'd have over in Earl's Court, there was the Coal Hern place, which was, you know, the oldest gay pub that is not there now, sadly. as many venues aren't.
Yeah.
But, you know, by the time I got down in London, I mean, it was, even in the 60s, it was known as the gay bar, before legalisation, as a leather gay bar, which I just found incredible. So you'd go in, like the Black Cap, like the RVT and the Coal Hern, were sort of three of the sort of bigger pubs, but you'd go into a separate door, and the Black Cap used to go down the alley, you know, and go into the back to see the cabaret. And that was where you were going to see the variety, you know, you weren't gay, of course.
No.
But, you know, but what I loved about the Cap when I went in, and the places that I had by that time been in, but the first place I went in and felt, this is my tribe, or this is a place that I feel comfortable. So, you know, I was there with my blonde spiky fur. I remember the first time I went in there, I was wearing a kind of 60s slim cut, sort of, like a mod suit, do you know what I mean, with this blonde spiky. It was like kind of Annie Lennox, sort of weird 80s thing.
I remember that look.
Yeah, that sort of blonde spiky hair, a little bit, had a bit of eyeliner on, and I went in, and it's weird, because it was kind of full of, it was sort of full of men in leather and jeans. And then you'd have, like, what we'd call a trans woman now sat at the bar. And you'd have, you know, like, really effeminate queens jumping around. And the mix was just wonderful. Ages were just everywhere. And I just thought, oh, this is such a wonderful, it, you know, it felt like somewhere I, you know, I could kind of sit and I didn't stick out. I mean, I was always too smart to be in the 80s. I felt like, you know, because I kind of love that sharp look. So it was a bit of a weird look for a gay man in the early 80s, because it was very kind of jeans and sort of slash t-shirts.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sort of almost like a skinheady look, you know, which always just baffled me. But I was more scar than skin, do you know what I mean? But I love the cap, because you could sit in there and it was that. So I think, you know, and I found my queer family there, and it's, I mean, I come from Yorkshire, and so growing up in a big family, we used to go to the Labour Club. That was our, you know, it was like the social club. So it's this massive social club. And my dad used to sing and still do turns. So I used to sing there. That's probably the first time singing. But that's, the cap became, you know, my tribe's sort of social club.
Yeah.
So even when I moved away, I mean, I lived in Camden for a long time, and then I moved to Islington, and then I moved to Greenwich later on. But, you know, even when I didn't go regularly, for maybe the last 10 years it was open, we'd always go there for birthdays. That's where we'd go. And if we were going out, like, on New Year's Eve, it was a fixture, because it was cheap and it was central and it would be just fun. And you wouldn't have to queue for hours. You know, it was packed. It just wasn't that kind of massive super club experience. It was just really friendly. So we'd do that. And so it became our weddings, sadly, a lot of funerals. And, you know, so it has a kind of resonance to me beyond sort of just being the first gay place I went and where I felt totally comfortable to go, oh, you know, look, you know, I'm my unique own person. What is going on? Everywhere we go, we're getting...
Do you know, pretty much any time I've
ever... I like, there's a bit of atmosphere
I've
there,
ever recorded, you know, in public, there's been sirens. Including in Harrow.
I should have broken into Police and Thieves. Police and Thieves.
There you go.
In the street.
Oh,
I love that song.
It's a good tune, isn't it? I do like it, but for ages, a certain partner of mine had it as her wake-up for the morning. I got really annoyed because she kept hitting the snooze button. And I was just like...
I want to hear the song.
Junior Mervyn, I Love You, but fuck me, I do not need to hear the first four bars over and over and over again.
I always think, whenever I sing that song, I do sing it in my set. I sing quite a lot of those sort of Lovers Rocks and sort of things like that.
Yeah.
And whenever I sing that in there, people are like, what the fuck are you singing? But they love it, because they've never heard it, most people.
I don't think a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to get into my conversion to Jamaican music, because that's not what the show's about. But we'll do that one time. Yeah, we'll do it 1 week.
So I guess, like, to segue back to the cap, if you like.
Tell us more about the black cap.
Yeah, I had this cycle accident, nearly killed myself. And while I was kind of recovering in hospital, I was, you know, it was like literally the sort of end of me recovering. And I hadn't really been out anywhere. And then someone said, oh my God, because there'd been this spate of closures of queer venues over the build up. I mean, something like, I mean, God, it's getting over 70% of queer venues or queer clubs, or et cetera, have gone in the last 10 years. But when you're losing kind of iconic, you know, we're talking about places that have a, you know, a deep significance to our community, and I think that's the thing that's so galling about losing something like the Cap. One, you know, it wasn't a failing business. It had been more successful, but that's just about how it was managed.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. So it wasn't losing money.
No, it wasn't. I mean, it was. It could have earned a lot more money. I mean, at one point, it was the most successful, highest turnover pub in the country. I mean, not just get the queer pub. You know, because it was just a money making machine, and through, certainly through the late 90s into the mid 2000s and beyond, it was just a money machine. You know, you think it was open in 10 in the morning, it didn't close till 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it would just be this wave of different phases where people were spending money on cheap drinks. But I think, you know, when I had this accident, and I just started to sort of potter about again. And heard, you know, like the Cap's closed. And I knew that there'd been a battle for about 18 months with the owner. Around trying to get planning permission to turn the upper floors into flats, and essentially that would have killed the thing. So that, I'd signed petitions, I'd kind of, you know, opposed the planning and things like that, like many hundreds of other people. But then it closed, and it was, oh my God, you know, that they managed, the charity was working on it, the Camden LBGT Forum. They managed to get an asset of community value placed on it, so the council, you know, giving it a kind of, it's a sort of protection for what it was, which is an LBGT performance venue. which is, it doesn't have much teeth, frankly, but it does add a layer of protection on it. And it's also got something called a sui generis listing, rather than an A3 or A1 or an A2 business listing. It's got a sui generis, which is of its kind, and again, as a queer performance venue. So those are kind of two locks that are on it. And those things were in place already, but when he lost the appeal for the asset of community value, and that was about a week before, and then suddenly it was announced, I think, to the team who were managing it and promoters there, that it was going to close. So on the Sunday, that was it. The doors closed. The place was packed on that night, but no one knew, practically no one knew who was coming, apart from the performers and the staff, that it was going to close that night. So it was announced. Bang, and then a week later we had this, you know, the We Are the Black Cat was formed, the social media took off, and we had about, I mean, and around 700, 800 people suddenly turned up outside. Well, we organised this mass protest, I was part of that, a bigger, much bigger group did that, and it was organised by the promoters, Meth Lab and the Family Fierce, primarily. So we all turned up, you know, and kind of, it was a massively amazing day. I've checked the website, you can see, and the Facebook page, you'll see these wonderful images. We had a double-decker bus, you know, and it was just very loud, and they had to cordon off Camden High Street. It was fabulous.
No, I love it when they have.
You know, and I think at that point it was the sense of, you know, outrage that they were one closing yet another venue, and it wasn't. And I think why people were so stressed and anxious and angry about it was because a lot of other pubs, and we know, you know, the way we entertain ourselves, whether you're on the queer thing or not, you know, if you go up, but the life has changed. People don't use pubs as they used to. But a pub on a high street that's purpose built, that was the days before full of hundreds of people, and had been for like the best part of, you know, four or five, I mean, you know, as a queer venue, as a gay venue, it was for nearly 70, 65 odd years. And, you know, it had been a money-making machine for its owners, but it had also been this, you know, it was never a point where it needed to close as a pub. You know, it was always, you know, even towards the end of its time open with this particular owner, who clearly wasn't that interested in running a pub. But even then, you know, the last 18 months, and we've now seen the accounts for that, I mean, he added another £500,000 on the turnover, you know, with the new promoters. So he kind of shot himself in the foot. But of course, he's been clever enough not to ever really say it was about it not being a failing business. But anyway, so unfortunately, the sort of protections at the time, so the assets of community value, which are given by the councils, didn't really. Landlords had a total right to just, you know, develop.
Yeah,
that's changed actually, and our campaign has been part of that change. So you don't have an automatic right now as an owner of a pub to just develop it and just assume that you have. And there's a catch all in most planning, not all, but most planning, certainly the London ones now, where you have to show, if you own a pub, I guess it applies for other businesses, but significantly pubs, that you have to show as an owner, demonstrate that you have done everything you can to make this function as a pub. And in order for you to be able to turn it into flats and coffee shops or whatever else, residential, of course, which is where all the money is, then you have to show in your planning that you have done everything else. And quite often now, I mean, and that's kind of built into the Localism Act, which is great, and that's only recent, actually, a couple of years ago that came in. So now if you own a pub, one, you don't have the automatic right to develop. Secondly, you know, you also will be asked by planners, will be rigorously asking, hang on a minute, why isn't it functioning as a pub? What have you done to try and make that work? And that's actually an important protection.
That's interesting where that protection's come up. Is that because of the wide shutting down of pubs?
I think, yeah, there's five pubs still a week close. I mean, you just think, God, how many pubs worth it? But I mean, you know, it's still the case. And, you know, we have to be realistic about it. I mean, it's, you know, when you look at the vast majority of pubs that close, you know, they close because they're just not used. They're not functioning. They don't really have the same sort of purpose. We don't use pubs as we did.
No.
But our argument for the cap, and we're involved in the Protect the Pubs campaign as well, the broader issue of it, you know, certainly as a performer who works in a lot of pubs, you know, just again, diminished pot of places to go and sell yourself. But yeah, I mean, the I've lost my track then.
Don't worry, mate. That's me pissing about with the plane. Exactly.
You distracted me.
I do apologise.
The sort of loss of form, certainly when you think about, and that's important, I think, that there's a benchmark, if you like, that will say, okay, so if we're losing vast amounts of pubs, there's got to be a way of measuring, is it just about you trying to buy this building and then asset strip it and loads of money out of it by turning it into residential? As we know, anyone who knows about running businesses, you very rarely, the actual building itself is often the least valuable part of it. Mm. It's really about the turnover of the business, the length of the business, the goodwill. So that's how the cost of businesses are judged, as opposed to we have a beautiful building in the middle of one of the busiest boroughs in the country that has can we turn this into flats that'll be worth £500,000, £2 million, whatever, each. And so I think what's important about some of the developments, and they're certainly not universal, and some boroughs, I think Islington, for example, has I've put a cap on all closures of pubs. So you literally, that as far as they're concerned, their planning will, you will very rarely ever be able to turn a pub into something else now without absolute serious consideration. So as well as the sort of, in terms of national government, the right, the automatic right to redevelop public housing and similar has gone, and you will be challenged on all sorts of levels, which is wonderful, but of course that all came too late for the likes of the CAP and some of the other campaigns like the Join Us and the President.
John Bounce, John the Rage, on Tracks FM.
Do you think this is generally a part of a wider context of gentrification, or do you see it as a particular attack on the LGBT scene?
No,
I mean, is attack a too strong a word?
I think it's a good question actually, because I think that, you know, there, it can get inflamed, because it's really, you know, the guy who owns the Cap, Stephen Cox, he owned a number of pubs, I think it was Butlers and someone around it, who were the land owners, the pub co owned it, small pub co. They sold on about 10 pubs to Stephen Cox Fawcett Inn. And Stephen Cox Fawcett Inn. I mean, you can't make it up because you... Catch up. and I don't think that was not... I certainly think that was deliberate when he made up Fawcett Inn. It depends how you say it. I'm a Yorkshireman, so Fawcett Inn it is... Anyway, so he bought a whole string of pubs, and this particular Butler and whoever they were, forgotten now, they owned a string of gay pubs. So, you know, he bought that, and I don't think for a second that he bought those in some sort of weird conspiracy to undermine the gay community. It just, if you look at the broader trend of pubs closing, and then you level that against the sort of trend of closures of queer pubs, of gay pubs. Then, you know, they're pretty, you know, it's just that they're not that vastly different. It's not a conspiracy to sort of undermine. I think there is this sense sort of like that, you know, do we need them now? We hear that quite often. Do we need them now?
Because about to ask you about that.
So to answer that question, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I don't think, you know, and clearly if you kind of, in for a second, that came out, then you. There are so many things that you could be. In many ways, I wish you'd said it, because then we could.
Oh yeah, would have been easier.
I've tried to trip him up, but it's never done.
Only you're homophobic, it make our fight so much easier.
And you know, I've obviously met Stephen Cox, the owner, and his. We call him Cox and Co. His group, and he just had like a sort of very expensive. It must be for him very expensive sort of group of lawyers and architects and people who surround him. God knows how he pays for them, but clearly he does. It's never come up, and we've never sort of accused him of that. And in fact, I mean, it's weird because I started this, you know, very involved in the campaign right from the beginning. And I think a couple of years ago, I was watching one of my friends do a Christmas show at Compton's, and Stephen Cox and his Fawcett Inn used to own Compton's, which is a really famous pub on Compton Street in Soho, gay pub. So I'm sat and we're on the stand, so I'm on the table because one of my best mates, Miss Kimberly, is this amazing cabaret act. So she's performing and I'm at this table and there's champagne flowing. It's not mine, obviously. And I'm sat with this guy and a number of other people, and then someone next to me goes, this person had got up and gone off to the bar or something, and that's the owner, that's Stephen Cox. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? I've been sat for about 2 hours with a guy who owns the Black Calf, you know, and I'd never met him before. None of us had at that point, I don't think. It was just bizarre. And I thought, well, is it appropriate while my friend's singing Jingle Bells or whatever she was singing at the, you know, Santa Claus is coming to town, is it appropriate for me to hit him over the head with a champagne bottle? No, it's probably never appropriate to do that. But, you know, it was just a funny moment. And I didn't sort of introduce... I mean, you know, I just carried on. I thought, it's Christmas. Come on, that's a big plan.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't think that he ever had that agenda. And when we've picked up on people saying, oh, you know, no, we're not having that, you know, because it's just not right. However, I do think, I think if you sat with him now and said, you know, these agitating LGBT people have stopped me, put two of my businesses into administration through, you know, not allowing me to do what I want to. And, of course, all of the money that he has invested in his portfolio, I mean, none of it's his. I mean, it's all sort of investment money from offshore companies, Russian oligarchs, and all sorts of things. It's a mix of people you would be, and we can show you if you want to spend 3 days reading it. But we know where all that money's coming from, and, you know, that's all available, it's all public knowledge. But it's none of it's his.
No.
And so, yeah, I think that we have played a significant part in driving Fawcett Inn to be put into administration recently, which, frankly, I'm very happy about. And another one of his companies, he's got about 10 of them, they're all offshore, you know, so it's very complicated sort of setup. You know, and irritating, actually, because even though we've tightened laws recently about, you know, sort of offshore money and, you know, hidden money, anyone can, buy a building in London or in this country, and as long as they have a kind of vehicle registered somewhere, you know, a company vehicle registered somewhere, as long as you show you've got the money, you don't even need to show who owns the fucking thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So that, you know, so basically, the very least they're doing is kind of having a vehicle offshore to sort of wash their money. But I mean, the worst they could be doing, where's that money coming from in the first place? And, you know, seriously, if you genuinely want to invest in, I know there's all sorts of, you know, tax reasons, but that's, isn't it? The best case is that they're washing money to sort of avoid a bit of tax. Well, fuck you, you know, yeah, what I mean? Exactly. But if you and I wanted to go buy, not that we could, obviously, in London, but if we wanted to buy a property,
yeah,
you know, we couldn't just say, oh, that money over there that we've had it under the bed our parents give us. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And like, yeah, well, obviously they're gone now, so I can't prove that they give me it. You know, we wouldn't be able to get a goddamn mortgage or pay for it. We have to prove where every penny comes from for us to buy our postage size stamp flat in fucking Palmer's Green or whatever. Do you know? Whereas actually you can just literally say, we're called XYZ Company, force it in, force it out or whatever, and just say, you know, we've got £10 million, we're going to buy these pubs. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Well, and, I think the more you have, the less questions anyone asked.
Yeah, but it's enshrined in our law that can happen. How is that? It's totally ridiculous that you can throw money into our country, buy chunks of our assets and you know, skew kind of markets negatively for people who live here and work and pay their taxes. And no one says, where does that money come from? I mean, you know, just think. I mean, it's shocking when you think, when you look at the detail of it. So, yeah, so no, long story, sorry, yeah. I've gone on a wife's birth here. But, yeah, I mean, so no, it never was an agenda around that. It's an agenda around gentrification, and more than that, actually, because I always say, like, improve, don't lose, that's gentrification. I mean, yeah. And I think that, you know, gentrification at its best improves an area, kind of makes, you know, like, works with what's there.
It works with who and what's there and doesn't try to force people out.
And that can be a really lovely and a sort of an improvement to often, you know, people argue about Soho, and I do think, you know, I've been involved in the sort of, you know, Save Soho campaign as well. But, you know, for me, it's like, I worked in Soho for a long time. I work in Soho a lot now with what I'm performing. You know, but you go there in 15, 20 years ago, and I can't honestly say it's not an improvement. So, you know, the difference between having, you know, clearly a teenage girl from, you know, sort of Eastern Europe hanging around on a street corner in a, you know, miniskirt and crack coming out of her nose is the fact that that has sort of, it's not necessarily disappeared, but it's certainly not hanging on the streets as much. So there's a little bit of improve in those things,
yeah,
but actually then taking it, you know, to another level where people are buying apartments above, you know, famous old, you know, sort of speakeasies, and then just leaving them empty. Or if they do live there, you know, they're not going to buy their goddamn milk there or nip down to. They're not going to do that. It's an investment. And what that does is it skews the market. You lose, you know, your local shop, you lose that market, you whatever. Because these people in these very expensive flats don't want to buy milk from a goddamn co-op down the road, you know, or whatever. So you change the flavour of it by focusing on the residential. And all these, you know, you get people who I mean, oh God, this drives me insane as well. Because I sing in a lot of pubs, and often, you know, you'll get people who, they come to a pub that's really famous. I could give you examples. So there's a pub in Camden called the Old Eagle. Lovely pub, and I play there quite a lot. And, well, did do. And then, and it's really famous for its Thai food. It's a gorgeous little pub, and it's ramshackled and loads of instruments in there. It's lovely. And then it's become, obviously, it's Camden, so it's very central Camden, so the houses, so people who come there for their, and this has genuinely happened, where people have come for their, oh, it's got a good review for its Thai food and the music, and they come there, and then buy a goddamn house down the road and then start complaining about the bloody music. Are you fucking kidding me?
They tried to do that at the Forum recently, too, like the Kentish Town, so, you know, formerly Town and Country Club, been there probably longer than all of us have been alive, and then they're like, oh, it's a bit noisy around here. It's like, yeah, you moved in next door to the Forum, you
You know, and this is the thing about, actually, it's an interesting point though, because the idea of, you know, because Cox has always maintained, Mr. Cox, owner of the Black Cat, has always maintained, and he's done this with the Comptons in Soho, where he sliced and diced it, acid stripped it, so above Comptons, which used to be a pub from top to bottom, is now two floors of a pub, and then above it he's got flats and he's developed those. Now, you'd argue, you know, the Compton's isn't a late licensed pub, it's in the middle of Soho, so if you're going to buy a goddamn flat in Soho, then you know it's going to be noisy.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, his principle is that he's done that, you know, sort of sliced and diced, asset stripped, many pubs, all that portfolio that we talked about earlier, he's done that with all of them, and the Cap is the last one. So his argument is, well, you know, we've done it elsewhere. But we know, all the evidence shows, is the minute you put flats above a pub, and again, I think Soho's a slightly different beast, but the minute you put flats above a pub, it just doesn't work. It doesn't live. I mean, and I think there's some stats from the Protect the Pubs campaign, I think. It's something like 18 months to 3 years, a pub that's been sliced and diced in that way will generally fail as a pub.
Yeah.
It will then be a coffee shop or a supermarket or whatever. And the thing about the Cap as well is that I think that people, and why actually he's failed to get his planning, is the Cap always has a late license. So it was never just a pub. You know, if you've got like 500 people disco dancing to Kylie to 3 a.m. on a Saturday, you know, the idea that you've got a couple of flats above you or 10 flats above it, you know, it's just not practical, really.
No.
And our feeling as well is for that business. And so we've always said, and we've always maintained, it's a, you know, a queer pub from top, from its, you know, ceiling to its basement. And it always has been, and that's why it works, and that's why it could run and be so successful in terms of turnover and popularity, is that it kind of provided these chunks of, you know, sort of time frames where you come in for a you know, coffee or a pint in the morning, and then it would be the sort of evening thing, and then it would, you know, if you were so minded, you could do the sort of out, and then the out again. Do you know what I mean? Because you could be there, oh, I'll just stay out, you know, and I'll go see a drag queen until 2 a.m. And that would happen, you know, most, you know, all through the week. So it had that kind of sense of you could be there at 10 a.m. and roll out at 2 a.m. if you wanted. And of course, you couldn't offer that range of phases of business if you've got people living above it, coming and going. Now, the other argument isn't his argument, is that, well, there's loads of flats around there, there are new flats being built. Well, our argument back is, well, yeah, there's a whole block of flats that have been built above, you know, the shops that have been redeveloped next door. But actually, only one of them has been sold. I mean, it's been you know, there's no one lives in them.
Yeah.
So why on earth, and, you know, his new plan, I mean, God, we've sat around a table with him, and it's gone on, I'd say, for about 4 years. So for about 18 months, we never saw him at all, but our fight was with, there was a couple of businesses that took the lease, essentially. And then our fight was with them. Initially, not a fight, you know, we met them, sat around a table, said, look, okay, you know, what do you plan to do? If you're willing to turn to open it again as an LBGT space that has performance, we'll work with you. You know, we represent this kind of thousands of people who want this pub saved. And, you know, we'd always get the same thing. Well, no, we'll obviously welcome anybody because it's illegal not to. Well, you know, but actually won't we? Because we don't want to exclude anyone. I said, fuck off. You know, the whole point of having queer spaces is that where we can meet on our own terms and meet our allies and make friends on our own terms.
Yeah.
You know, and that is why you have venues like that. You want people to say, oh, we don't need queer venues. Well, I'll argue that if I turn up to the pub opposite, which is the World's End, used to be the Mother Red Cap, sister pub of the Black Cap. So if I go there, as you sure know that pub,
I know.
You know, if I go in there, and sometimes we have after the Cap, so we go in there, and while, you know, it's not particularly unfriendly, but you turn up there with, you know, three trans women, you know, a couple of very loud sort of queens and a drag queen, and you know, you immediately become a focus of something, and it's not always positive. And you know, and you are, even though, you know, often nothing will happen, there's a sense of you having to sort of surround yourself with a big sort of backpack of, you know, like caution. And I, you know, I just don't really see why there has to be some spaces where you can just throw that backpack of caution off and just be yourself. And
I mean, this fascinates me because, again, it comes back to what we were saying earlier on about mainstreaming, and it seems to erase, maybe not even on purpose, but it can't help itself.
Yeah.
Because it's all lowest common denominator.
Yeah, we're not. This is the one thing I love about the campaign. It's grown to the state where, and someone else said it to us, it wasn't me, but someone said, well, it's interesting that the campaign has now become the sort of the most high profile sort of queer campaign anywhere in the country, because it's just on the street, it's visible, it's very colourful, good humoured, but at the same time, you know what we're saying on the street, and I think all of us appreciate this, you know, is that when the group's on the street every week, what we're saying is we're not invisible and we don't intend to be.
Yeah.
And your point there, I mean, what the other side to this is certainly places like the CAP, which not only was it a pub, you know, where, you know, queer people could go and meet each other, because of the scale of it, it never ever said to anyone on the door, this is a gay pub, you can't come in if you're gay. What it would say is, do you understand this is a gay pub or a queer pub? And if you, as long you're fine and you're welcome, as long as you understand that. And what was great about that, and I've met so many people outside the pub, from, you know, people who are ex-army, ex-landlords from pubs and their whole families, who say, this is the first place, I'm straight, they'll say, but this is the first place I ever came and met gay people and actually realised that it was just, you know, that there was nothing to worry about, or that, aren't they good fun, or whatever, you know, they were, you know, there was nothing, and changed their opinion and perception. And that's really important.
We still need it.
We still need it. And I think that the other side to it as well, is that as a sort of creative person and a singer and writer and everything, is the CAP also, as well as its scale, you know, it was a place that had, and it was quite mainstream, the drag there. It wasn't sort of like what we'd say, like queer cabaret or anything. It was very much, you know, old style drag queens, and occasionally you'd have, but they used to do a lot of kind of new act nights and things like that. So a lot of new people. So it was always creating, and it was a creation of an art form that only really exists and can exist in venues that are LGBT.
But you need that in so many forms, because it's so much of the stuff that I like in life is not easily categorisable, and you would, unless you have a kind of alternative venue to try these things out. It's never going to, it's not going to happen.
Yeah,
because I mean, you can't if you do something that's a bit off the wall and it's kind of funny, but it's not a comedy act. You can't take it to a comedy club because people go, this is funny.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you need exactly. I mean, one of the things I'm doing with Loud and Queerly is sort of you know, we're looking to take those shows that we're creating and take them to places and venues. So we just launched a couple of weeks ago, we launched our first monthly, which you two must come to.
Yes.
That's Julie we're talking about.
Yes.
who's not here, by the way.
To be honest, and the thing with the Black CAP thing on a Saturday afternoon, I definitely would do, but I actually work most Saturdays.
Yeah.
So I'm often not here.
Yeah, and we always say to people, like, you know, people say, oh, it's a shame I can't come to the vigils, or we haven't been to them. Look, we all support in the way we can. I think, and just doing something, liking something on Facebook or Instagram or something, is real, and posting it on. Doing the kind of selfie thing that we do, you know, with the sort of wig, anything you can do within your own time. But it is more than anything, it's just share it, just talk about it.
Yeah.
And that's more than enough.
This would be a good point, by the way, just to mention the website and the Black CAP.
Yeah, so the website, so the Facebook page is We Are The Black CAP, and the same for Instagram and Twitter. Strangely enough, the website is We Are Black CAP. Don't ask me why, and that was done not by me. But if you just Google We Are The Black CAP, you will get all of that.
You get that a lot.
Join if you're listening and you want to know more about the campaign. You can join. In fact, the Facebook page is really kind of where, which is the kind of, yeah, the sort of parent page. We've got Instagram, and obviously, you know, these social media platforms change a lot. And so all of those platforms are on, but Facebook tends to be the place where we kind of like, you know, post a lot.
Well, that's good, because this is, I mean, I'm wondering how much support people can give internationally, because this little show of mine seems to be strangely popular in odd parts of the world. So, hello Bermuda,
hey! Yeah, but people want it, there's on the website, come to the website, there's a place you can donate. We have to keep a fighting fund, and we've managed to do that on very little money over the last 4 years, but, you know, inevitably, you know, we're not fundraising at the minute to try and buy the pub, because that's just not really feasible in the current situation. Yeah. We would love, I mean, ideally what we'd love is to have a queer consortium, if you like, to buy the venue and run it ourselves and make sure it's future-proof. But in reality, we're talking about central London. The cost of the business, and certainly buying the freehold, is really out of our reach. So the work we're doing generally is looking to find, sort of build consortia, if you like. And we've got some really interesting good behind the scenes, a couple of Hello. A couple of interesting, they're just arriving now on a bike. A couple of interested investment groups who are really keen, and we're talking to them at the minute. But you see, anyone who has expressed an interest just comes up to a closed door with the owner. He's just not interested. I mean, he's been in the long game.
Well, he wants to do what he wants to do. That's pretty obvious.
He thinks, and he's still the case, is eventually, and again, keep in mind it's not his money, that eventually that we'll go away, the council will flip, and he will be able to then maximise the return, the long-awaited return on the building. And at some point, the point where that doesn't become feasible. But again, if you think about it, that he's not losing anything. You know, he's obviously, you know, his businesses are closing and stuff, but it's not really his money. No. So, you know, those people who have invested will have to chase him for the money. And of course, the asset will be there, because they'll obviously at some point, I would imagine, one of those businesses or those investors will go, we'll then own the cab. Yeah. And we're trying to communicate with them. But ideally, what we'd want is that we find a way to buy it ourselves, and then which we'd love, but I mean, and that isn't off the table. But
co-op
in terms
of community ownership,
exactly. Well, one of the things which we had touched on is we set up the Black Cat Foundation, which is a not-for-profit company. That was so we could raise money to sort of maintain the campaign. So the Black Cat Foundation sort of runs the campaign, but it also does other things. So we run these other events. We also advise other campaigns how to do it and more than anything, how to maintain it, because that's the secret, really. We should have, so many campaigns go by the wayside and we haven't, and that is because I think we set up something like a proper vehicle. We've got six directors with different skill sets, and then we have a sort of group of about another 40 people who are kind of hardcore, we call them black captivists, who just are outside and pick it.
Captivistas.
Black captivistas. they're wonderful, if you do join the Facebook group or the social media sites, you'll see how colourful. And it was Julian Cleary, the comic, said in Twitter a few months ago, he posted this thing about, really hope these guys win. It's a sort of a really important, good-humoured, relentless campaign. And I really like that it has been the front end, and I think that's one of the reasons that it's enduring, is that we have some humour about it. And of course, it reflects what the cap was. You know, it was colourful and camp and loud and leery and gaudy. And I think, you know, we do, as well as the vigils we do every Saturday, every couple of months, two or three months, we do what we call sing out for the cap, so they won't let us perform in there, so we put a show on. So I produce a little show, we'll have drag queens and jugglers, and we just take the street over and do that, and they're really great fun. And of course that people remember them. So if I'm outside and I'm not singing, people will say, what are you singing? Do you know? My other half says that all the time. I'm not singing Tourette's. And I think that those kind of bringing it back to life, and we've taken that, and this is where we met, when we've taken that out to other venues where we've done Not Another Night at the Black Cap, which is about looking at, we know that since the cap closed, that cabaret, certainly queer cabaret, has changed. Mm. And so what we try to do is what would happen on a Wednesday night at the Cap? So we've put on these shows where we sort of showcase slightly broader talent base and I'd like to see the Cap do that in the future. But ultimately, you know, we always end the show with a really fabulous fabulous old style character drag queen.
Not old, very, very young, good looking.
You know, I think the whole drag scene is incredibly interesting and diverse and quite strangely weird at the minute, and it's very fashionable. Mm. But ultimately, you know, the Cap was always about brilliant, almost what you'd call sort of variety act cabaret. Mm. So, you know, people who sing and tell jokes and have a character and have stories. But then it would also be, you know, a really fantastic sort of breeding ground of interest. And it always moved with the times. I mean, we do get that said often by people in our own community. We'll say, well, you know, you're just trying to sort of, we don't need a museum. Well, actually, it's a different story. We do need a museum. Yeah. But we're not trying to make the Cap Museum. What we are trying to say is, why should we lose, and we touched on it earlier, why should we lose venues where we can still touch the wall of a place that kept us safe and provided us with a safe place before it was legal? When it was illegal to be gay and, you know, homosexual, this pub And there are so few places where we have that history. You know, you and I now could list probably two or three suffragettes.
Well, for now, Alex Green, thank you very much for talking to All the Rage.
Thank you, John.
Solidarity all the way.
Here we go. And come on, comrade.
I'll see you in the streets of Camden.
I hope so. All the Rage with John Bowd. www.tracksfm.org.